Time for another instalment in our series on great New Zealand sporting moments. And with the Women's Rugby World Cup kicking off at Eden Park this week, we thought it'd be a great opportunity to have a look at the history of women's rugby in Aotearoa. Someone who knows all about this is commentator Alice Soper. She's also a member of the Strategic Advisory Group for Women in Rugby Aotearoa. And Alice joins me now. Hi there.
Kia ora. How are you doing, Jesse?
Good. Really nice to have you back on the show, Alice. We always enjoy talking to you. And a chance to get a bit more historical today, because I suppose for a lot of people, women's rugby may have appeared on their radar sometime in the last 20 years. But how far back do we have to go for the origins of this story?
Right back to the beginning, mate. So I think the first recognised game, so this is a recorded one, that we have reference to is 1888, which was a match that was played here in my hometown of Wellington between the Wellington High School girls and the Hallelujah Lasses, who were a Salvation Army team.
Wow.
So, yeah, all the way back then. And I can also tell you that women were first paid to play in New Zealand in 1891.
What?
So we've been here since the beginning. Yeah.
So we had women's rugby before we had suffrage in New Zealand.
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing. If you look at the waves of organisation around women trying to get into the game, they do marry up quite a lot with the waves of feminism.
Yeah.
So not surprising that around the late 1800s, we first had that organisation trying to come together and tore off the ground.
I guess so. And you... Yeah. And you know they were paid because you've seen an advertisement from a Mrs. Nita Webb in early June 1891.
That's the one. So unfortunately, they never actually got to tour. So we do have to say that. But they were paid to come together and to train. And that was all, you know, teeing up. And it was very interesting. A lot of the rhetoric that you saw kind of written up around their people opposing this tour from going ahead, not dissimilar to some of the things you might see in the comments sections today.
Oh my gosh.
Essentially that it's quite unwomanly for women to be playing, you know, the man's game. So very funny that, you know, we're 100 plus years later and we're having the same stereotypes being thrown at our women.
Right. And I know you're too smart to read through the comments, Alice, but if you ever did, it would be easy to feel like you were living in 1891.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all very fun. I think it's going to be a good one that we'll be able to cross off the list of favourite hits around people not being interested, because we know that there's 35,000 seats that are going to be filled at least this weekend, with the last couple going fast. So, you know, when people say people don't want to turn up, well, tell that to all the people that are planning to this Saturday. How good's that?
Yeah, that's so cool. So cool. And I know they had high hopes, but were kind of a little bit anxious to see if people would come and you know, build it, and they will come. It's going to be a huge day and going to break all sorts of records. And back to the 1890s, we've actually got a newspaper clipping from that time. They call it female football, and they promise that the hair will be cut short and care will be taken not to play a rough game. That I don't expect you've ever had that sort of agreement before a game.
Oh, I mean, it's funny. I know there was a quote from the 1888 game where someone said, "Come down my lane and I'll throw a bucket of water over you." So, you know, they might have had the rules in place, but the women were up for it and were playing, playing the real thing from the get-go. No, you know, it's always one thing that we do think in women's rugby. You know, I did play netball when I was young, and, you know, they check your fingernails before the game.
Yeah.
And I always thought they would be quite nice if we'd do the same in 15s. They check your boots, but not the fingernails.
Ah.
So I've got quite a few scratch scars from from people breaking a nail on me here and there. But
yeah,
1800s, then it went through the 1900s too, mate. A lot of that was tied to exhibition games. So there used to be a thing called Queen's Carnival, and so we would often be involved there, and we'd play one-off matches. They were fundraisers often, you know, raising money for the war effort, and then other matches that were raising money for, you know, clubs to get going. But it really did seem like it was just a one-off. It was difficult for these women to get to organise. Although I would encourage anyone that's listening, please go and check the photo albums in your attic, because there is so much of our history that is still in people's heads, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There are photos of teams from the 1920s, and we don't know enough of the story around them. You know, there's photos of teams from Horowhenua Kapiti from 1923, I believe. They can't just be one team. They've got to be playing other people. So it'd be awesome if people could go and try and connect these dots, you know?
Yeah, that's just logic, isn't it? If there was one team of 15, there was probably another one.
Well, you'd hope so. It'd be pretty lonely out there. Although my favourite story is there's a very plucky woman. Her name was Phyllis Dawson, and she was in charge of trying to start up rugby here in Wellington again in the 1920s. And her and her crew, they trained in secret at night. They did end up actually playing a game against a team from Napier, and I think another one down in Canterbury. But in between this, they were having trouble getting local games. And so they went down to the local rugby field in trench coats. And when they got there, they throw the coats off and challenged all the men to a game. They said, "We're ready.
Oh, wow.
Put us on." And people were very impressed with the spectacle. They, you know, everyone was like, "Oh, not sure, not sure." Then there was an injury on the main field. So they all ran over and said, "Put us on. We can be a substitute." But it was the ref who said, "No, I don't think we can be having that. We can't be having a woman joining in there." But, you know, they've been trying. They've been trying for a long time.
Yeah. Okay, I've got lots of questions. Just one, and I hope this isn't an ignorant question, but hearing you talk about nails in the 15s, are there any sort of rules or precautions in the men's or the women's game around long hair? And I guess it would come up more often in the women's game. Of course, there's some famous long-haired male players as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, eh? Because you do see from time to time penalty being given when someone has like head hide because they've accidentally grabbed a handful of hair as well. There's not that I know of. And look, I'm sorry to all my friends who are referees who are yelling at me right now and saying subsection 2.3. But from what I know, I don't think there's any kind of consideration for long hair. It's just something that when you have had it, and you know, when I was younger and I did had more hair on my head, you always just make sure to tie it up because not too hard if you're going on the wraparound to end up getting a handful of hair and choking yourself backwards. So, No, the only kind of safety checks that they do on your person before the game is to line up, check your boots. You can't have them sharpened and causing any trouble in the rucks.
You mentioned that Horowhenua team and in that photo they're wearing, I'm seeing a description, jerseys, shorts and boots, and some in socks and others in stockings. I don't imagine you've ever played in stockings, Alice.
No, I haven't. No, I think it's always just been a regular cap. For a lot of the time, it's the bloke's hand-me-down, which, you know, there's another push that is coming around there now, because some of those cuts aren't the best for us, particularly if you're thick-thighed. You know, we're good at scoring tries, but it's also good at giving you a bit of chafing if you're wearing those little shorts.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still some ways to go to be making people design stuff that's really for our bodies too. And you're seeing that slowly change, which is good.
Yeah, speaking of changes too, the photo appears to show a female chaperone for the team.
Right, that's very League of Their Own, right? Which, if you've been watching that that series recently, you know, you've got to make sure that these women are behaving well at all times.
Yeah.
I would have to say we probably did have, not female chaperones, but we would definitely have our managers keeping an eye on us on tour. And I was a young one playing with a women's team when I was, you know, 13-odd years old. So a couple of those women looked after me and were my mums when we'd go away.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned before that the story of women's rugby has parallels with the story of feminism in New Zealand and just general New Zealand history, I would say. And I was really interested to see the name Fina Cooper, who was elected as the president of the North Hokianga Rugby Union in 1947.
Yeah, and look, that's one of the ones that at this stage I'd have to say is probably the earliest example of a woman being in charge of a union, which is awesome and entirely unsurprising, right? Like, what hasn't that woman achieved?
Yeah.
Like, but apparently she was so forceful about her opinions and disagreements with refs that she would be able to get all of the board together to have meetings on her list of complaints and things that needed to be addressed. So, hey, rather than do that, just put her in charge of the thing, I guess, probably easier to manage.
But if we look at kind of significant periods in feminism, you mentioned the 1890s, but then it was also around that wartime era, wasn't it, when the men were away and women found themselves in new roles? And was that a bit of a time when women's rugby took off or had another little burst of energy?
Yeah, so that's definitely when those exhibition matches that I made reference to before. So there were a lot of, you know, annual games that were held during that period in the 30s and 40s. And you see that pop up all over the country, you know, down in Dunedin, up in the north, all over the place. And it was just that case of it was difficult, I think, for women to then be allowed to organise in between. So we didn't necessarily, and I say necessarily because, like I say, the history books are still in people's heads, we didn't necessarily have the same situation, say, with football over in England, where you had, you know, huge scenes during that period. We didn't necessarily have that here, but I think you do then get that kind of echo of those, I think, that feminist wave coming into the 70s and 80s. That's where you really saw the modern day rugby. That's where it started kicking off for real.
Yeah, you have a friend who was, you mentioned looking through old family photos. You got a friend who found a pretty cool photo.
Oh, yeah, no, my friend Rosie, who used to play here in Wellington, another hooker, and she's over in France now with her partner, but she was telling me that her grandma, she was having a look through a photo album and found a photo of her grandma playing, and that would have been, you know, 40s, 50s, I think, and that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. They're all over the place, and you can, you know, so yeah, like we say, go check the attic, because it's how good to think, oh, actually, grandma, you were doing some amazing things back then.
Yeah. Is there an official attempt to collect some of these archival materials, photos, newspaper clippings, to try and build a story, and particularly, I guess, while some of these people might still be alive?
Oh, mate, you're giving me another project to do, I think. And look, there's something, and that I have had a conversation with a dear friend of mine, Ellie Donnelly. Now, she's actually just written the book on the history of the women's game across the world, from the 1800s to modern day. And we were talking about that. Like, she's managed to pull a lot of that together through research, through, you know, oral histories from players that were around in the 80s and 90s. But that there is that gap that exists in so many places, and that there's actually a worldwide filling in that we need to do. Because a lot of the time, yeah, what we've got is what was deemed interesting to write about. But that doesn't mean that's the whole story, as we know. You know, there'll be so many things that people thought, oh, that's not worth sending a journalist along to.
Yeah.
And that will be really key parts of our history. So that does, yeah. Just because you don't have a record of it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
And well, we've talked before about the kind of the unconscious bias that's shown when it's men who are writing history, right? They are drawn towards telling stories of men.
Yeah. And not only that, but also just the framing. So, you know, that game, that team that wanted to tour back in 1891, that really was pitched as a little bit of a laugh. You know, it played into that whole thing, that vaudeville, like, look at these women trying to be men, you know, like that type of imagery. And you see a lot of that in the way that people wrote. And to be honest with you, all the way up, and probably until the late 90s, the way that a lot of people were framing, you know, I think there was a headline, different gender, but don't call these All Blacks tender, you know. So there's been a lot of this stuff, and we've still trying to overcome that, I think, across the board in women's sports, that we tend to talk about things with an element of worthiness rather than excitement, and I think we need to move beyond that.
Okay, so through to the 70s and the 80s, and some big changes start happening to the game internationally and here in New Zealand.
Yeah, so look, that was basically when women decided, oh yeah, we're going to do this and we're just going to get on with it and not ask for permission. So you had a bunch of different clubs. So in the 70s, that was up in Auckland, and I think a little bit in Christchurch as well, and that's where women started organising their own club competitions. I know here in Wellington in the 80s, they did the same. That was organising your own jerseys, your own refs, your own fields, and your own competition. And that, you know, all built through to the late 80s, when then started, you know, perking up and picking things up there. So there were a couple of key things that happened. One was the late, great Laurie O'Riley and his influence in Canterbury in particular. So he took a team called the Crusadettes on a world tour in 1988. And he organised this tour via fax machine, which meant that he had sent a bunch of faxes out to try and tee up some matches. And then he hadn't heard from people, so he sent a few more. And then it was only a few days before they were, you know, due to head out, and then they started getting a wave of them all in. So they ended up teeing up 21 games in 36 days. And so they travel across the States and across England. And good thing the team was up for it, because they actually ended up winning 17 of those 21 games. And it was those connections that particularly for our New Zealand side, our place in that history, those connections that were built on that tour, that then started that momentum into the World Cup. So 88 was when we had that World Tour. 89 was when the Pacific Coast Grizzlies came to New Zealand, and we had our first Invitational New Zealand team. This is the one that is recognised as the first kind of Black Ferns match, and that was played down at Lancaster Park in Christchurch. So that was a team that Laurie coached and helped select there. Then you fast forward to the next year, 1990, Rugby Fest, which is a tournament that not many people know about, but it was one that was held again in Christchurch, and it was kind of one of the first multi-country tournaments to be held in the world. And so you had USA, I think it was USSR, as they were at that time, and Japan, who all came together and played, again, down in Canterbury. So they New Zealand won that one, which was good. So we'd hope for a repeat, obviously, with our one that's coming up in the weekend. But then from that 1990-1991, that's when that first World Cup took place. And that's really the fantastic work of a group of women over in England.
Yeah, and actually we've got some audio from an interview with one of the English organisers. This is Alice Cooper.
The demand grew out of the European Cup, which was played 3 years ago in Bourg-en-Bresse in France. And it was agreed that Great Britain would host the next European Cup, by which time America, Canada, New Zealand had already asked if they could come too, which would mean it wasn't technically a European Cup anymore. So we decided to invite any international standard rugby-playing nation.
What do you want spectators to come away from these matches saying?
So many people come with misconceptions, what they think they're going to see. And I think anybody who comes along will have found within 10 minutes they forgot they were watching women playing rugby.
So that's Alice Cooper there remembering the first Women's Rugby World Cup, which I should say Alice Soper, who I'm speaking to for New Zealand Sporting Moments today, didn't get a heck of a help along by the IRB at the time, from memory.
Oh, no, yes, it was unsanctioned. So I think we even had to maybe not call it a World Cup to avoid getting into trouble. I think it was maybe a World Tournament instead. Alice Cooper's going to be in New Zealand, I believe, for the World Cup. So I'm very much looking forward to meeting her in person.
Wow.
But yes, yeah, I know, I'm very excited about that. And there's actually, again, it's a funny thing. There's been no books on women's history, and now there's a flurry of them. So I understand there is also a book coming out around those four women that organised that first tournament. So, yes, they got together actually at the club I played for when I was in England, Richmond, and they decided, let's just get on, let's do this thing. So they sent out those invitations around the world to pull a bunch of different teams together, and one of those teams being New Zealand. And we got our team together, and it was a squad of 26 that ended up going over, and they had to fundraise to pay their way. So at that time, I believe it was $5,000 each. So that's around 10 grand by today's standards to pay for the privilege to represent our country. Now, it's interesting, that whole asking forgiveness, not permission thing. I understand Jerry Paul, who was the flanker in 91, she told me that Laurie decided that the fern would look good on the jersey, and he maybe didn't ask whether that was okay. So they were unofficially known as the Gal Blacks at that 1991 World Cup.
Interesting. That might ring a bell with some listeners. The Gal Blacks, Wow.
Bit of a cringe one. But yeah, so that one was only just recognised this year, actually, by World Rugby. For a long time, it had not been included because it wasn't sanctioned. But it's this funny tension that happened in the early 90s, because the women weren't affiliated in a number of cases with the male governing union. So they didn't realise that they had to ask anyone's permission, right? Like, they weren't in the tent, so they didn't know they had to talk to anyone else in there. And so that's kind of where a lot of the tensions and controversy around 1994 came through, because that was due to be taking place, I believe, in Amsterdam, and then got pulled at the last minute because of pressures that came from IRB. So IRB then you know, put pressure on their member nations and said, you know, you can't be participating in this unsanctioned tournament, which is why New Zealand didn't feature in 1994. But that tournament is remarkable, even more so, I think, than 91, because Scotland, when they received the memo that the tournament had been cancelled, they went down to the pub and they decided, well, we're going to organise it. And they did in 90 days. And I understand that that was the only tournament to this date that has turned a profit. So amazing what those women were able to do.
And, yeah, it strikes me that, as so often happens when we're talking history, the rule breakers and revolutionaries of the time, the ones who would have gotten into a bit of trouble, are now viewed as pioneers and the start of a great tradition. You know, that should be a great inspiration to anyone who's, you know, found themselves kind of going a different way and being a bit of a black sheep in a sport or in a community that actually, you know, maybe they will be one day remembered as the first to do it the right way.
Oh, absolutely. And my hope is that eventually we get past that, right? And we can actually celebrate these people in the moment for wanting to break that new ground and for, you know, dreaming bigger than what we have right now. And I think that's something that's really important for people to remember about the history of women's sport in particular, is there's a history of radicals. You know, none of these women were supported to be doing anything initially. They had to just, you know, decide that, yeah, we are going to do it, get on with it, and then you prove the point by what you're putting out there, and eventually people will come around. So, yes, absolutely, continue the tradition of your foremothers and be the radical that we can be.
Okay, pop quiz, Ellis. Who won the inaugural 1991 Women's Rugby World Cup?
Okay, so do you know that that is, in New Zealand rugby women's circles, like the equivalent of the Susie the Caterer conspiracy. So you know how, you know, apparently we were food poisoned and that's why we lost, blah, blah, blah. In New Zealand women's rugby, they will tell you that we were robbed in 1991 because we were actually apparently due to play England in the semi-final, but the draw was rejigged and we ended up playing USA, who were the eventual winners, in the semi-final. And that was a very close game, but they got the best of us and then went on to smoke England in the final. So yes, there were a number of people, I know that that was something that always grinded Laurie's gears, that he was robbed of his chance to be in that first final.
I want to make some time to talk about the Soviet women's rugby team and that. Was it that tournament that they were resorted to some pretty creative ways of raising money?
Oh, yes. Now, they kind of turned up and caused a stir everywhere they went in their early 90s. But in 1991, they turned up at the tournament at the border, and they brought with them crates of caviar and champagne. That was their, oh, sorry, and vodka, I should say, with the French team bringing champagne.
Yep.
Caviar and vodka, because their intention was to barter with that for their accommodation. Now, obviously, the English customs said absolutely not. And so they got stopped before they even got to Wales. And so everybody had to end up pitching in to support the Russian women to get up there and be a part of the tournament. And I know that when they came down here for Rugby Fest, they also caused a stir because, you know, they would be very glamorous, which was maybe not our New Zealand side's style, but would make sure that they had, you know, all the makeup, the beautiful lipstick in the hair and everything, all good to be putting on a show.
Yeah, our team tends to wait for the Hellberg Awards to do that, right? On the field, it's all business.
Exactly.
Okay, let's just run through these results in some of those other Rugby World Cups then. I'll just start randomly from 1998, champion New Zealand, 2002, champion New Zealand, 2006, champion New Zealand, 2010, champion New Zealand. In fact, we've won every World Cup since then, apart from 2010. What happened in Twickenham?
No, 2014. 2010 we did win, robbed it. But 2014 was the shock of our lives when we were actually beaten by Ireland in pool play. And that was a shock dismissal. And at that time, so this is something that's also new about this tournament, well, old new, they've reintroduced the quarterfinals. That had been removed, and so that was why in 2014 when we didn't have the opportunity to get through because it was straight semi-finals after pool play. So that's something that's exciting to see come back at this year's tournament. But yes, I would argue, Jesse, that's another whole whole longer podcast, mate, around that maybe we didn't necessarily heed all of the warning signs for our program that were there in 2014, which I think kind of reared their head again at the on the Northern Tour that we had in 2021. You know, we won 2017, but there were a lot of kind of things that were floating around, but we hadn't necessarily addressed the root issues that caused that performance in 2014, which is around not enough test matches and having some pretty short domestic competitions and all of that type of stuff, and the other, you know, countries really getting their act together and putting in some proper programs. You know, for a long time in the Women's World Cup world, it's been a case of talent v talent, and we've always had the best talent in the world, but now it's talent plus program. And I can't necessarily argue that we have that anymore.
So to 2022, and this is unbelievably the first time that the World Cup has been played in the Southern Hemisphere. Is that significant?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity for New Zealand, who, yeah, we have this amazing record. And I think that part of the reason that maybe we aren't so aware of it is because most of it's happened overseas. Most of our test matches have been played around the world, and those, all of those finals, obviously, every time we've lifted the cup, it's been in the middle of the night because it's been played in England and Amsterdam and in France. So you don't necessarily get to have that visibility. So to get to have it here in our backyard is so exciting. And it's also exciting for the all the participants to be in a country that loves rugby as much as New Zealand does. You know, we're not, it's a different sell to a public that's already rugby mad versus, you know, sometimes you might be popping up and you're in a country that doesn't maybe know as much about the sport. So very exciting opportunity for all involved, and for us, like, and by us I mean people like me who are absolutely mad about women's rugby, to get to see our niche passions become a mainstream one for a whole 6 weeks.
Yes. Disappointed not to see more Pacifica teams in that draw. Fiji are in there. They were the winners of the Oceania playoff, but I guess there's only so many teams from this part of the world that you can have in a World Cup.
Ah, now that's an interesting one. So COVID really cut off the road for Samoa. So they actually had this World Cup, again, different, and I'm going to try not get too in the weeds for you, Jesse, because it's a bit complicated.
All good.
But this time we had proper qualification tournaments to get through, right? And part of that was there was, you know, different ones around the world. So there was like an Asian-based one, there was a Europe-based one, there was like America's, but there was kind of and then also a repechage tournament. So people that had become, if you were the best runner-up, you were supposed to come together and have your kind of last chance roll of the dice to get into the World Cup. Now Scotland won that place, but Samoa was due to go to that qualifier, but COVID prevented them from doing so. So it at that stage we couldn't guarantee, well, the players couldn't guarantee that they would be able to, you know, get back from where they've come from, and that the cost of having to be in MIQ or in quarantine for that period, they just couldn't make it work. And so a real shame. But I do know that Manusina are incredibly passionate about making their way into the 2025 World Cup. And there's some really exciting stuff that's actually just around the corner in terms of the introduction of WXV, which is a new tournament that's going to be starting from next year, which basically assures that all countries that are, you know, currently playing, we've got three tiers of that competition, so 16 different nations that will be having regular test matches. How good is that? That's going to have a massive impact on the quality of rugby of play that is played, but also the different options that are now there for players. I know that there are a lot of New Zealand-based players that are proudly Samoan, proudly Tongan, proudly Fijian, who can now look at paying for their nation of origin because they have an opportunity to. For a long time, they may have loved to play for Samoa, but there might only be a chance every 4 years when there's a qualification, you know, opportunity going on. But now we will have regular test matches for these nations each year, and that's something that's really special.
I've only got one more question, Alice.
Yeah.
Are we going to win?
I have to say yes, right? But no, I don't know. This has been an incredibly, like, England have got a 4-year jump on us. They went professional after the last World Cup. And so I'm going to be realistic about that, right? that it is theirs to lose. But that doesn't mean that we cannot do it. It just means that if we do, it is going to be one of the most outrageous stories. And hey, our history is full of them, so why not another one?
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you to you for all you've given to the women's game and the game in general in New Zealand. Alice Soper, great to chat to you, and go the Black Ferns.
Thanks, Jesse. Cheers for that.